So today I continue to discuss this action I introduced at the end of the last lecture, which is the action, the analog of the Maxwell actions for the Maxwell electromagnetic field, but for non-abelian field. So remember what we did last time. We saw that we are looking for a non-abelian gauge theory, so a theory involving vectors, vector fields. Spin one that obeys a symmetry that is not the U1 symmetry of the Maxwell field, but a non-abelian gauge series, abelian gauge symmetry, symmetry group G, which will be taken to be in practice SU2, but this is general. And we have seen that if we work in the fundamental representation, which is the basic representation of the group SU2, G can be represented by an element G belonging to the group, so a symmetry transformation, can be represented as a 2x2 unitary matrix. With determinant one, of course. And therefore, it can be written in as exponential of I times some matrix alpha, which for an infinitesimal transformation, namely a transformation closed to the identity, can be expanded in the power of alpha, where the alpha belongs to the Lie algebra G, which in our case will be the little SU2, and the alpha are Hermitian traceless matrices. Okay. And there are three of them. That's the algebra has dimension three, so the dimension of G is three, which means that alpha can be, any element alpha can be written as some alpha A, TA, where these are the components, those are complex numbers, and these are the generator of the Lie algebra and the generator of the group, namely the, where these are the Pauli matrices. And we have seen that it's natural since there are three generators of the symmetry. So basically, you have three different kinds of symmetries you can act on and combine them to make a full group of symmetry. There should be three vector fields, three vector potential. A mu A, with A equal 1, 2, 3. Three instead of one for the Maxwell field. And we have seen that these are just numbers. So these are real field. The alpha are real component. I'm sorry, they are real and complex, of course, because the dimension is three on the real numbers. And we can regroup this into a matrix that is simply A mu A T A, which is again a 2x2 antisymmetric matrix. So this field belongs to the adjoint representation of the group, because it's a Lie algebra of the group. And we have seen that in order to have a local gauge invariance, the analog of the U1 local gauge invariance by of electromagnetism, we need to define what are local gauge transformation on the potential and to define a field strength, which is
different from what's going on in electromagnetism. So we have seen that first, gauge transformation on AMU is given by AMU change into AMU plus some capital D mu of alpha, where alpha is a generator. So alpha depends now on X, and it's a generator of a local gauge transformation. Okay, so it's a 2 by 2 antisymmetric matrix. Okay, with three independent components, traceless, and d mu is a covariant derivative, which is defined when it acts on alpha. D mu of alpha is simply the ordinary derivative in the direction mu in space minus I times the commutator of AMU with alpha. Remember, AMU and alpha are matrices. And that's the covariant derivative acting in the adjoint representation. Okay. Okay. And so you see that a local gauge transformation differs from the case of the Maxwell field by this term that is non-linear. Well, it's linear in alpha, but it depends on the gauge field. So a gauge transformation is defined in a different way for a different point of space-time if the gauge field is not a constant. Okay. So that's the difference with Maxwell field. And this just comes out from the requirement that we want to have this non-abelian symmetry group acting on it. Okay. So from that, we have seen that we can define the field strength tensor, which is the natural generalization of the electromagnetic tensor in Maxwell's theory. And it is defined simply as, well, formally, a bit formally, it is defined as a commutator of two covariant derivatives. And covariant derivative, you see, depends on AMU. But it turns out that this is, if there were ordinary derivative like in the Maxwell field, this will be something simple. Here it's more complicated. And if you make the calculation, you found that this is, what's the general definition? So it's a component, it's a 2 by 2 matrix. Okay, and each of its components is F mu nu A equal D mu A nu A minus D nu A mu A. This is the ordinary term we have in the Maxwell theory. And then we have a minus I times the commutator of A mu and A nu. Well, that's a general, if you want, that's a general formulation in a 2 by 2, if we deal with 2 by 2 matrices. And in terms of component, we have F mu nu A equal D mu A nu A minus D nu A mu A. And then we have plus the structure constant, which is epsilon ABC of A mu B A nu C, where this is a structure constant. The group SU2. So for a general group, it will be replaced by the FABC, so the structure constant FABC. Okay, in general. Okay, and this field strength tensor transforms covariantly under a local gauge transformation. That's the important point. So under a local gauge transformation, where mission, while A mu, as we have seen, transforms like this. F mu nu, which involves a derivative of alpha and a commutator, A mu nu transforms in a way that doesn't involve the derivative of alpha. That's how it is built. So F mu nu, where is this formula? Chop. Yes, so under a low, in fact, under a better to write it in terms of a global gauge transformation, because under a global transformation, gauge transformation by a factor of g of x that is now exponential of an infinitesimal one, you can show very easily that f mu nu transform into g of x, f mu nu of x, g minus 1 of x. Okay. And again, that's the difference with the Maxwell case, because in the Maxwell case, this is a pure phase. So in fact, the f mu nu is invariant. Here, it's covariant, because it has several components. Okay, so that's what we did yesterday. And something I didn't write, but it's easy to write, that if you want to write, so F mu nu, as there are three field strengths. So if you want to write F mu nu A in terms of an electric field EA, and the magnetic field BA, HBA, in the usual way. And if you write the vector potential A mu as an electrostatic potential V and the vector potential A, magnetic potential, then it's easy to see that the relation between E, for instance, E1, the first component, it's indeed d dt of A1 minus gradient of V1. That's the usual term that comes out from Maxwell's equation. But then you have a V2 A3 minus V3 times A2. So you have a nonlinear terms that involves the potential, so the electric potential and the vector potential of the two other fields. So, and the same for B1. B1 is equal to, of course, rotational nabla, the cross product of nabla with A1, but then you have also the cross products of A2 with A3. So you see that the relation between the electric and magnetic fields in Nabelian theory and the vector potential, the gauge potential, is more complicated. And it has to be in order to respect this on abelian symmetry. Okay. Okay, so now this was just reminders. And now we wrote a Young-Mills action, the action from which the Maxwell equation will derive, and this action for the gauge field takes a simple form. It's just we take the generalization for a field strength that is now not a pure number but a matrix, but we take a term that is a product of f mu nu squared, so we take minus 1 over 2 g squared integral over d4x, the trace of f mu nu, f mu nu. Okay? And I have a minus, etc., because I am using, here I am in the Minkowski matrix, so h mu nu is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay. I'm in four dimensions, but that's a form, a formulation that works in any dimension. Okay. So g squared is a coupling constant. It's the analog of the E squared in QED, where E is the charge of the electron. And we have to take the trace, because we want to have something that is gauge invariant. And it's clear with this formulation. So it's a trace with respect by the two, on the 2 by 2 matrices, of course. And we sum over indices. Okay. And it's clear that when we do that, if we make a performer gauge transformation, we get a trace of g f g minus 1 times g minus g times f times g minus 1. And by cyclic permutation of the trace, this is the same as trace. So this is the only gauge invariant action involving two derivatives of the with respect to the field. So which has a proper power counting. Okay. And a bit of, if you are a bit careful, remember that A mu is a 2 by 2 matrix. So it will involve, when you express it in terms of A mu A, trace of products of TA, TB. And since the trace of the products of two generators is just 1/2 of delta AB, this means that this action can be rewritten as minus 1 over 4 g squared integral d4x f mu nu a f mu nu a, when I am raising and lowering indices in a trivial way for the gauge indices. So these are group indices. Okay. Good. And you see immediately for this expression that there is a very important difference between the U1 case, because F mu nu doesn't involve only this derivative term, but this term involving non-derivative of the gauge field. So the Lagrangian density here will be non-linear or non-quadratic in the gauge potential. And it will involve terms involving products of 2a and 3a. So basically, the Lagrangian density, which is f mu nu a, f u mu a proportional to this will involve the usual Maxwell term d mu a nu minus d nu mu a squared, but it will involve in plus terms of the form dA with an A and an A, and term involving 4A with a lot of factors will be the epsilon AB and some delta AB that I'm going to write later. But this means clearly that this is, if you want, the kinetic part. It's like the part that describes the propagation of photons, as in Maxwell's theory. But this describes interactions between the gauge field. And why is there interactions? Well, that's quite simple. That's simply because there is a current associated to the symmetry, to SU2 symmetry. So in fact, there are three currents because there are three generators. And if you work out what is this current associated to this action with a 1 over 4 g squared, you find that the current associated to the pure gauge field theory with no interaction with matter, it's non-trivial, and it's, if I'm not mistaken, there is an epsilon ABC F mu nu B A nu C, which is different from zero, because we have the structure constant of the SU2 field. So this means, what does it mean? It means simply that the gauge fields or the gauge bosons carry charges. They are charged, and so they interact. The gauge bosons, which are vector bosons, are charged in difference in the Maxwell theory, where the photon is not charged, so which makes QED so simple, because photon can propagate from one end of the universe to the other without interacting too much, except with electric and magnetic field and atoms where there are some. But that's why the universe is transparent, and we go, okay. Good. So we are going to discuss that a bit more later, but before that, let me discuss now the coupling with matter. As in QED. So, coupling of matter is performed easily, in fact, by the usual rule of replacing derivative in the Lagrangian for matter with covariant derivative. And covariant derivative behaves in the proper way under gauge transformation, so that we get an action that is locally invariant under gauge transformation. Therefore, that respects the symmetry. Okay, so let us first discuss the coupling with Dirac fermions. That's the simplest, namely there will be quarks and leptons in the standard model. So, well, up to the fact that the quark and leptons are some chiral properties that I'm not going to discuss here, but so now, if we have a Dirac field, it belongs to the adjoint representation. So we call this as a psi, a vector psi, with I equal 1, 2, because it belongs to the to the fundamental representation. of SU2. So you have two charged species of fermions that have the same mass, the same, are related by the symmetry, but, and the gauge transformation will act just by the gauge transformation will be simply that I'm changing psi into g of x times psi of x. That's the generalization of changing the phase of the Dirac field. But here now the phase is a matrix. So this is a two vector, and this is a 2x2 matrix. Okay? So gauge transformation mixes two species of fermions. Okay? And then the action will be for the Dirac, let us say the action for the fermions, will be simply integral d4x. And instead of taking the standard Dirac action with the d slash, I take a covariant derivative slash minus m psi. So that's a shortened notation. But of course, that's a shortened notation for writing that this is ddd of x. This is psi bar of alpha I of x, where I, remember, I is a group index in the fundamental representation. So I goes from 1 to 2. Alpha goes from 1 to 4 and is a Dirac in index. And here I have the usual I gamma mu alpha beta times the ordinary derivative, which will be, so there is an I here. So there is a delta IG d mu. That's the d of the ordinary derivative. And then there is a minus I A mu A of x, the gauge field. And then the generator of the gauge transformation, namely, it's a matrix, so I have a TA, which is a sigma matrix. A Dirac matrix, okay, acting on the IG indices. So this is a Dirac matrix. I'm sorry, not a Dirac, Pauli matrix. Okay. And then I have a minus M. And this is just an identity matrix, so I have a delta alpha beta and a delta IG. Okay, here I close my parentheses that correspond to this. And here I have a psi G beta of X, where okay, now the A equal 1 to 3 are also group indices, but referring to the adjoint representation. Okay. And so you see that the fermion index contains this term plus this term, that is the ordinary action for Dirac particles, and the term that contains an interaction. So we have an interaction term of the form psi bar A mu A psi, but with indices that carry the spinor structure, the fact that the Dirac field is a spinor, and the fact that it obeys this non-abelian gauge theory. Okay. So finally, let me discuss the case of, so this was Dirac fermions. And now let me discuss the case of a scalar boson, namely, but a scalar boson, not a scalar vector, not a vector boson, so with spin zero. Okay, and that will be important in the standard model because that field describes the Higgs boson. Okay, and again, now I have a field phi that has two components. So this is a phi I, with I equal 1 to 2. So each phi is a charged boson, so it's a complex. So each phi I is a complex field because they carry charge. And again, the action for the scalar boson will be the generalization of what we have for this. So it will be 1/2 of d mu phi bar times d mu phi. I have to take the complex conjugate in order to have something that is neutral, plus m squared over 2 phi bar phi, plus g over 8, that's a normalization, phi bar phi squared. Where, again, what is phi bar phi? It means just phi bar I, phi I, some I, and what is d mu of phi? D mu of phi is a covariant derivative acting on phi. So d mu of phi is the ordinary derivative acting on the vector field phi. Minus I A mu times the vector field, where this is a matrix and this is a vector. Okay? And when you take the d bar of phi will be phi bar here. So d mu of phi bar will be d mu of phi bar plus I A mu phi bar. But you have to take the transpose, so you have to be a bit careful. Okay, anyway. This is also gauge invariant, as well as, of course, as this action. And this is gauge invariant because if I perform a gauge transformation on the field and on A, d slash psi transform into g of x times d slash psi. And the same for this. And for psi bar, it's transformed into g minus 1. So this is gauge invariant. Okay. And in this case, well, the interaction is not very different from what's going on from the Maxwell theory coupled to a scalar boson, because you are going to have the usual propagation term. You have you are going to have the standard interaction, and you are going to have an A phi phi and the A phi phi interaction terms coming from one or two mu phi. In fact, there will be a phi d mu phi and the a phi phi. So an interaction depending on the derivative. So okay. And I have stated there is a current, and in general, the total current will be the current of the matter. Current G mu A will be the G mu A for matter plus the G mu A for the gauge field that I have written here. And for instance, for fermions, the current for fermions, for Dirac fermions, is just the usual psi bar, gamma mu, TA, well, TA is sigma A divided by 2 times psi. So the only difference with the current for in QED, which is psi bar gamma mu psi, is that there is the generator of each gauge transformation, symmetry transformation in each direction, as you may expect. Okay. Good. Okay. So let us draw a little bit more what is the diagrammatic you expect from this symmetry. Then if you work out exactly what's going on, these terms, so you have naively, you expect from the gauge field. So if you now you want to try some Feynman diagrams, what you expect? You expect that the gauge field AA. Oh, if you want to perform Feynman diagram, you have to find a small parameter. What is a small parameter? Well, the small parameter, as usual, will be the charge. Well, coupling constant G. And it is the G that appears in the Young-Mead action, not the G well, let us call it this H. H is a coupling constant for the boson, which is different matter. Okay. Oops. The charge will be the coupling constant of the Young-Mead theory. Why? Because you see that if you just make a change of variable A mu into G A mu, the Lagrangian for this A mu becomes the usual. The original Lagrangian was a 1 over G squared times these terms. You will have the D mu A mu minus D mu A mu squared, the usual term from the Maxwell theory, plus a G times term involving dA, A, and A, plus a G squared terms involving 3A. So you expect that you will have a propagator like this, which of course will depend both on the Lorentz indices and the gauge group indices for symmetry, because it corresponds to simply to having computing A mu A and U B in the theory where this limit where G equals zero. So in the Maxwell approximation of the theory. But now you have a three gauge field interaction, okay, which is with some mu A, nu B, and nu rho C that will depend on the coupling constant. And you expect a four dimensional vertex that is proportional to G squared, okay, with a complicated group and Lorentz structure that I'm going to write later on. And here again, you will have mu A, mu B, rho C, and sigma D that correspond to computing the vertices corresponding to these terms. Okay? And, well, let me write it because you'll see what's going on. This vertex, chop, chop, chop. Well, okay, no, don't, let us not write it some terms. They will have a structure that I'm going to write tomorrow. You see just how it's going on. Okay. And again, now for the coupling with fermions. So this is for the gauge field. So this describes vector bosons, the analog of the photon that carry now a charge, interaction between, and the interaction term between the gauge boson. Okay. And now for the fermion, we expect to have the original Dirac propagator and the fermion's psi carries a Dirac index, and now a charge index, because it corresponds to psi alpha A, psi bar beta B in the free theory approximation. And we expect an interaction term that is exactly the same form than for the between the bosons and the charge fermions. So that's for the fermions. And now for the scalars, we expect to have the ordinary propagator that is unoriented. Oh, the boson is charged, so this is still oriented because the boson is charged. And this will just carry I and G. This is indices, the fermions and the scalars belong to the fundamental representation. So they carry the two index I equal one or two of the fundamental representation. And again here, this is a scalar boson, so no Lorentz indices, no spin indices. And now we have two interaction terms. You have an interaction terms of this form, I, G, A, mu, and an interaction term of this form, where you have two A, mu, B, mu. Okay. And there will be the correct momentum dependence and group structure indices, which makes the thing covariant. So these are basically the basic interactions. And in addition, of course, since we are dealing with, in general, scalar boson, we'll have an interaction like that, which is the usual interaction for the boson. And of course, this is over the one, this is over the G, this is over the G, this is over the G squared, because there are two bosons, and this is over the H, the coupling constant of the scalar boson. Okay. So, it seems that doing a perturbative expansion of this is straightforward. Yes? No? No question? So, yes?
Pardon? No. For the scalar field, there's only the index I and J?
I'm sorry?
For the scalar field,
yes,
it's only I and J?
It's only?
I and J? Like I?
Yes, yes, index. Because the scalar bosons, the scalar has only two indices here. So this corresponds to computing in the free approximation phi I, phi bar G. This is the only object that is cage invariant. And it depends only on I and G. Okay. Well, this is not gauge invariant, but this is gauge covariant. It carries indices. So it's psi bar psi, which is gauge invariant. Okay. Good. But in order to see that, you have just has to count the degrees of freedom. So the boson carries just SU2 charge in the fundamental representation. The fermions carry, the Dirac fermions carries SU2 charge in the fundamental representation plus spin. And the gauge boson carry SU2 charge in the adjoint representation and spin. But here it's spin one, so it's a vector, so it's labeled by the spin content is labeled by Lorentz indices, while here it's spin 1/2, so it's carried by Dirac indices. Okay. Okay, so now, well, up to all the group structure coming from the symmetry, it seems that we can perform a perturbation theory as in QED. Okay. But before doing perturbation theory, we must deal with the problem of gauge invariance and of gauge fixing. And why do we get a gauge? For exactly the same reason as in QED, in Maxwell's theory. That's because different AMU correspond to the same physical configuration of the fields because of local gauge invariance. So there is a redundancy in the description of the physics by a vector potential. And that's, we cannot escape that because that's a consequence of the structure of the theory. We want a theory with a global symmetry, with vector potential, and it turns out that it's much, much more convenient to describe the dynamics of this theory in terms of vector potential, because the vector potential transforms easily in a simple way under this symmetry. So it's much, much easier to describe the physics in terms of an vector potential rather than in terms of electric and magnetic field. And you see in this case that the relation between A and E and B is quite complicated, which means, for instance, that both the dynamical Maxwell equation and the constraint equation on E and B, which are quite simple in Maxwell's theory. For instance, the fact that B is nabla wedge A implies that Nabla wedge of B is zero, will be replaced by a much more complicated non-linear constraint equation relating B and the electric and the magnetic fields of the other component of the other charges. Okay, so. But the price to pay is that we have this redundant information and we must deal with it with a gauge fixing procedure. Yes? Pardon?
So far,
I have not used any gauge fixing because precisely I have derived what is the most general form of the action, that is gauge invariant.
And what would happen if we just continued without fixing the gauge?
You are going to see that immediately.
Okay,
so I'm going to answer your question. Okay, so what should we do? Well, I'm going a bit slowly, but that's fine. Why do we need gauge fixing? That's simply, let us look at this term. Chop, chop, chop. Sorry, I'm a bit slow. Oh, yes, here it is. Okay. So let us consider only the linear part, or the quadratic part, let us say, the quadratic part of the Young-Mead action, which is just, so this is just minus 1/4 of d mu A nu A minus D nu A mu A times D mu A nu A minus D nu A mu A, where I am raising and lowering group indices just according to the matrix one, so my notation AA is the same thing than AA, but of course A mu is H mu nu A nu, where H is the matrix of the Lorentz signature. Okay, good. And the same for the derivative. And you see that in, so this is diagonal in A. So basically, if we go to Fourier space, Fourier transform, by writing that A mu A of x is of the form integral d dx of ei k times x times A mu A of k, where this is a Fourier transform, then, and that's, I'm sorry, d mu k, or 2 pi k, then this can be written as a quadratic form of the form d mu nu a b of k, where I replace the d mu by I k mu, and this is simply delta a b, so it's a trivial group structure, times the usual minus k squared h mu nu plus k mu, k nu. Okay. So this is a quadratic form in momentum space with spin indices and group indices that we have to invert. If we want to compute this propagator, the propagator in momentum space, the propagator for the gauge field, if I have a moment with this index mu a and mu b, this is simply the inverse of this quadratic form of k with a matrix element mu a, mu b, as we did for the scalar propagator. So we have to invert this matrix. So the inversion with respect to delta AB is easy. That's just delta. So this is delta AB times the inverse of this matrix, which is this is a 4x4 matrix. Okay? And because of gauge invariance, this matrix, so let me call this matrix d mu nu. As in, so this matrix d mu nu has a zero mode. You can check very easily that d mu nu of k times k nu is identically equal to zero. Okay? And this is a problem in QED. This is why we have to fix the gauge. That's because if to the right of D we put a vector potential A mu of K of the form A mu of K of the form K mu times some AA, and AA may be a function of K, but it's a scalar function of K. This means that this D mu nu times A nu is equal to zero. But such an A mu, if you go back to what is this A mu A of X, this is simply a D mu of some AA of X. Let us call this alpha. So this is a pure gauge. Changing A mu by a pure gauge transformation doesn't change the action. So this term, which give you the variation of the action is zero, because the variation of the action under a gauge transformation is zero. Okay, so problem, d mu nu is not invertible. As in QED. So that's why we have to fix the gauge. We have to choose some representative of A mu, which corresponds to a unique physical configuration. So to a physical configuration of the field, we have to associate a unique configuration of the gauge potential. Okay, so so gauge fixing means that in QED, we choose a representative of the A mu that is lift this degeneracy. And gauge fixing in QED is quite simple because you can use what's called the axial gauge. A not equal to zero, or the Coulomb gauge, which is that the nabla of A equals 0, where A is, so A naught is, so A is A naught A. Or you can use the Lorentz gauge. Well, it's sometimes also called the Landau gauge, which is covariant. This is d mu a mu equals 0. So the advantage is this Lorentz invariance. Lorentz invariant. Well, this is not. Okay, but it's convenient for some problem. For instance, in the Hamiltonian formulation where you have a preferred time direction, this axial gauge is very convenient. And there is a variation of this Lorentz Landau gauge due to Feynman that I'm going to discuss tomorrow, where this is not constant, but this is fixed. But, and, well, for QED, that's enough. So fixing a gauge, namely projecting d mu nu out of a direction where there is a null vector, and performing the calculation works well. We are going to see that for Young-Mill theory, this is not so simple. But very interesting. And it reveals another aspect of the physics of gauge theory. Okay, so let me, I have just half an hour, so let me give you the basic idea. So here I'm going a general geometrical pictures. Of what is a gauge fixing. Okay? So, of course, first, I want to perform, it's my favorite method, so I want to quantize my gauge theory by using functional integrals. So, I want to use a functional integral. So, let me restrict just to a pure gauge, so at that stage, no matter field. I want to define something that will be an integral over all the KLV configuration of exponential of minus of I, if you want, I times the Young-Mills action, the gauge action of A, where the gauge action for the A has been written here. And this means, roughly speaking, products over X. Products over A of D A and products over mu, of course, products over mu of D A mu A of X. Okay, very roughly speaking. Okay, it's a measure over all the possible field configuration. And the question is, how can we perform this functional integral by method of perturbation theory? Okay, so the picture is the following. Let me call A, some capital big A, the space of all A. So it's a space of all vector potential, gauge potential configurations. So it's an infinite dimensional space, and since I'm a theoretical physicist, I'm not caring about how it is defined, which metric I put on it, which topology, but this can be done. Okay, so I have a big space. I hope you see that it's not, is it okay if I use this? Okay, so I have my big space, A. And this is a point So here's typically a point. So a point here corresponds to a given A. So now let me denote big calligraphic G, the space of all G, where G, so A means, here A means a collection, a function A mu A of X. Let me denote calligraphic G, the space of all gauge transformations, all local gauge transformation. So G means, in this notation, similar, it's a function G of X, with X belonging to Minkowski spacetime. Okay? And G belongs to SU2. Okay? And again here, X belongs to Minkowski spacetime. So this space of, so it's a space of mappings, if you want, if you prefer, that's a space of mapping from M 1, 3 to the group G equal SU2. Okay? So these are all the possible gauge transformation, local gauge transformations that I can perform. And now, we know that performing a gauge transformation amounts to change a given configuration A into a new configuration that I'm going to denote AG, A index G, where, as we have seen, A of G is simply, well, in shortened notation, G times A times G minus 1, plus I G times D of G minus 1. Well, this is D mu. Remember, this is a shorthand notation to write that under a gauge transformation, A mu A transform of G times A mu G minus 1 times I times G, G times D mu of G minus 1. And remember, all of these are 2 by 2 traceless antisymmetric Hermitian matrices. Okay. So starting from A, the given A here, if I perform a gauge transformation, I get another A of G somewhere else in the space, another configuration. And when I take all the G, I get something that is an orbit of the big group G. An orbit of G acting on A. So the, by gauge transformation, you saw this is an action of calligraphic G, that is an infinite dimensional Lie group, on A, the space of gauge transform, gauge connections, gauge, gauge potential. Okay? So G is an infinite dimensional Lie group, but in fact, it's just the direct product, if you want, of G. So this capital G is just, if you want to have notation, the original Lie group G equal SU2, and the product on all points in space-time. So it's a direct product, so it's a Lie group. Simply, there's one copy of G for each point of space-time. Okay. So it's an orbit of G. And so such, all the orbits describe the same physical configuration. And so the space of all gauge potential is divided into what's called the foliation by the action of the group. And if you want to write it if you want to write it in a sketchy way, the space of physical configuration is the quotient of this A by G. It's a quotient space, the space of leaves in the foliation. Okay, that's a mathematical. Oh, so it's not. Okay, so. Oh no, I don't need that. I still need this picture. So now, what is a gauge fixing? A gauge fixing consists simply of taking one representative in each foliation, in each orbit, I take just one representative. Okay. And this will be called a gauge slice. So I make a slice orthogonal, if you want, at least not tangent to the leaves. Okay? So this is a. Okay. And you can do that in different ways. So let me take another color. So different gauge condition corresponds to another slice. And you have an infinite way to do that. So you have to look for the one you prefer or the one that is most convenient for your calculation. Okay. And remember, along a gauge orbit, the action is constant, while along a gauge slice, you expect that in general, the action will not be constant. So when performing a functional integral, which relies on applying the saddle point approximation, you have to look for the point where the action is minimum, which you expect is to be what's happening when A is a pure gauge, so that F mu nu equals 0. So somewhere here, there is a vacuum state. F mu nu equals 0, pure gauge. Pure gauge means no electric and no magnetic field. That's the vacuum of the series, a classical vacuum. But when you perform your integral, you cannot perform the saddle point approximation in this direction, because precisely, this is not invertible. So you must treat differently integration in this direction, where you can perform use the tools of saddle point approximation and perturbation theory, and this one, where you cannot. Okay? So that's precisely what a gauge fixing condition is. And the point, the difference between QED, so the U1 theory, and Young-Mills with an SU2 group or a non-abelian group, is that separating between this and this is quite trivial in U1, and it's highly non-trivial in non-abelian gauge theory, because in some sense, this space is a flat space for the U1, and this space is curved for SU2. Because remember, F mu nu is a it's a commutator of covariant derivative. So in fact, F mu nu, in some sense, measures the curvature of your space of connections. And the fact that there is a non-trivial commutator means that even if you have a connection which is constant, d mu a nu equals 0, f mu nu may not be 0. So even the space of constant gauge potential is curved in non-abelian. So you have to take this into account. And that's the idea of what we are going to do. So, oops. Okay, so now, what corresponds to choose a gauge fixing condition like the axial gauge, the Coulomb gauge, the Lorentz-Landau gauge, etc. It corresponds to choose a slice, one of these orange or red slices, and you do that by fixing some function. So you choose a gauge fixing condition, f of a equals 0. So you choose a function a. What does it mean? I choose a function f, which a, which in fact is a function that leaves, that maps the space of gauge connection onto itself. So it's a function of the form f a of a of x d mu a of x, eventually other derivative. So I choose this. Yes, I can write. Let me write this here. Because a d a etc. at point x. So f of a is a function that the given connection associate another connection that may depend on A and on its derivative. And we assume that it is zero at any point. So for instance, for the Lorentz gauge, this function FA of A will be simply d mu of A mu A of X. So I am writing in a very compact form the fact that some set of constraints on A are equal to zero. So it's a set of constraints. Okay. And this set of constraints, you see, depend on A, depend on X, but do not depend on mu. Doesn't depend on the Lorentz indices anymore because you choose a gauge. Okay. Good. And so this this set of this gauge slice is the set of A that satisfies such a constraint, such a set of constraints. Okay. And so, what we'd like to do is so naively fixing a gauge would consist in writing my big functional integral. So this is my d of a. I have my exponential of my action, is gauge A, and I want to choose a representative in each point. But now, how can I do that? One has to be a bit careful, because you may say, okay, let me just put a delta function for f of a. Let us write it in a very sketchy way. Delta of f of a, where delta of f of a means, in fact, products over all the points of space-time products of all my group indices from 1 to 3 of the fact that the constraint FA of A at point X is equal to 0. Well, this is an ordinary delta function, and this is a delta distribution in the space of constraints. So this is a delta distribution located on the slice. Okay, so we may say this naively, but it turns out that this is not independent of the choice of F, namely of the slice. So something went wrong. We have to be more careful. I'm going to explain why it's independent. So, the trick to compute this in a properly well-defined way was invented in the 50s. So, in fact, the main name associated to this as Bryce DeWitt. And Feynman, Richard Feynman, and later on and independently, Fadeyev, Ludwig Fadeyev, a great mathematician, and Popov in Russia. And I think DeWitt was mostly interested in quantum gravity, extending gauge theory. Feynman interested in gauge theory. Fadeyev and Popov were interested in non-abelian gauge theories. Okay, and the trick is the following. The trick consists is, so I have this big integral, let us say. I have this big integral dA that I want to estimate. I over SG of A. Okay? And let me multiply it by, so this is an integral over A. Okay? And let me multiply it by what I'm going to do is so I'm starting to this integral. And let me multiply this integral by 1. But I'm going to write 1 as an integral over the space of all possible gauge transformations. So let me write this as an integral of a dg. Okay. And for each g, I'm going to write a delta function of g minus some g of a where g of A is the gauge transformation such that one has to be a bit careful. A of G of A satisfies F of A of G of A equals zero. So you see, for a given A, there is a gauge transformation that maps A onto my gauge slice. And if I work well, this gauge transformation is unique. Yes? Sorry, could you speak slowly?
So we're describing the gauge transformations that leave us in a direction that's parallel to the gauge fixing.
Of course, I'm just performing a gauge transformation, so I'm not just changing the physics.
Yeah.
And all the A of G describe the same physics. Okay? So this is for a fixed A. If I choose a A, there is a GA such that A of G of A is on my gauge slice, and this is a bit of a transformation, but what means D of G? This means simply product over X of D mu of G, where this is the R measure of G of X. This is the unique invariant measure on my SU2 group. And for SU2 is a compact Lie group, so there is a unique measure. And delta of G minus GA means basically products over X of delta of G of X minus GA of X with this Dirac invariant measure on the group. So it's a delta function, but defined in a covariant way on the group. Okay. Okay, so I do that, and I had, so I'm not changing anything here. So I can add to this integral over G, D of G, delta over G minus G A. Okay? Okay. And now, well, I'm going to stop now, but I'm going to explain to you what we are going tomorrow. We are going to make the interchange. And, well, it's quite obvious that you can rewrite this as an integral over dg of d of g. I can rewrite this as an integral over a d of a exponential of I s g of a. And I can rewrite this as a delta function of f of a of g times something. Because I can make a change of variables because of gauge invariance. For each g, instead of integrating over a, I can integrate over a of g, because the measure doesn't change. The action is invariant, the measure is invariant, so I can change my integration over the A into the integration over the image of A by G, because I have inverted. And in this case, I get just a delta function of f of a of g that enforces the constraint that g is precisely the right one. But when doing this change of variables, I am changing a delta function of g minus ga, into a delta function of f of a function of g. And there is a Jacobian in general. Because if you have a function, let us say, if you have a function on the real axis, and you have a function to function x, you have a function f of x, that is a real function. That's a function like that. To x, I am associating a function f. And this function f at some point x naught, f of x naught equals 0. I cannot write integral of dx delta of x minus x naught. I cannot write this as integral over dx delta of f of x. There is the absolute value of the derivative of the function here that has to be taken into account. I'm sorry. So when you look for picking up just the solution of some equation in an integral, by writing, I integrate over all the points and I have a delta function of the f of x, then this is not equal to this, and this has to be multiplied by the derivative of the function. So that's what we are going to do in this infinite dimensional big space, and that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. Okay? And we'll see that this has an important consequence for the definition of perturbation theory. Okay?